Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. Hey, welcome back to Breaking Down Collapse. Kellen and I are super excited to dive into today's episode. But first, I just wanted to remind everybody about a couple of ways to reach out and contact us if there are questions, suggestions for the podcast, or complaints.
Actually, if you've got complaints, we don't want to hear them.
All right, the man has spoken. You can reach out to us on Twitter at CollapsePod. Find me on Reddit, user Corey John, KoryJon. You can also send us an email at breakingdowncollapse@gmail.com. So at this point, Kellen, we're going to kind of dive in deeper. Like we've mentioned up to this point, it's kind of been Collapse 101. We're about to jump into Collapse 201. So if this is the first time you're listening to the podcast, we're glad you're here. Do recommend going back, though, and listening to the first 8 or 9 episodes. Those are the ones that are going to really give you a solid foundation of Collapse, of what we're talking about. Because today we're going to dive in a little bit deeper, and what we're going to talk about does piggyback off of an earlier conversation that we had, specifically in episode 8. About climate change.
Yeah, I'm really excited to dive deeper on climate change because I remember when we went through it before, it seemed like of all the topics, this was the most inevitable and the one that is most sure to, at some point, cause collapse.
Yeah, for sure. And I also think that it's the topic that has the most to it. So today's topic piggybacks off of that last episode, and there are going to be many more episodes that will piggyback off of this one as well. So just like we barely scratched the surface last time, we're going to go deeper today, but there's going to be chances for us to go even deeper into each part of today's episode as well. So one of the questions that you asked last time was, what is a feedback loop? Because I had mentioned that those are extremely important in climate change, and I gave a pretty brief example. But what I want to do today is talk about a little bit deeper what feedback loops are, their role in climate change, and we're going to talk about something that's extremely relevant right now in the climate crisis and that many in the Collapse community are talking about. There's an abbreviation for it. It's called BOE, and so you probably see that all over in Reddit. A lot of new people are constantly asking in the subreddit, what is BOE? So we're going to talk about what a BOE is and why it's so important to climate change.
Great. Let's do it.
Okay. Well, it's important to understand what feedback loops are because they are the primary cause of the whole faster-than-expected phenomenon that we talked about last time. So a simple definition of what a feedback loop is they're a process in which the outputs of a system are circled back and used as inputs. So that's the definition you'll find on Google. Basically, what that means, and I'll give some examples in a second, but first, just know that feedback can be positive or negative. So positive feedback means that it will become a self-enforcing loop that takes the system away from equilibrium, whereas negative feedback means it will neutralize itself and maintain the equilibrium. So as a very simple example of a positive feedback loop, we're going to go to the savannah for a minute and just picture a group of water buffalo out grazing in a field.
Oh no, is Mufasa about to die?
Sure, we'll say that Mufasa is hanging out nearby. So one water buffalo starts running. That is an output. The overall level of panic in the herd is low, but enough to cause another water buffalo to start running. So the fact that there are now two water buffalo running spooks even more. So now there are 5 that start running. So now that there are a significant amount running, it spooks half the herd, immediately followed by the entire herd running in a stampede that sends Mufasa careening down a cliff to his death. So in this example, there are 2 main criteria. There's a number of gazelle running, and there's a level of overall panic in the herd. Those are our 2 criteria. As one output increased, it increased the other, which in turn increased the other in this ever-expanding loop, right? So another more practical example would be if we used the 2 criteria of infant mortality rate and medical advancements. So if we make a medical advancement that decreases the infant mortality rate, then there are going to be more kids who will grow up, some of which will probably end up being doctors and scientists, which increases the likelihood that we'll have further success in new medical advancements, which means that there will be more kids to grow up to be doctors and scientists. So basically, each output feeds positively on the other output and causes a continual growth in the system.
As you say that, I feel like we can find these feedback loops all over the place. We've talked in previous episodes, we've made little comments about mental health. So I feel fine saying that several years ago, I got hit really hard with depression, and it felt to me like it came out of nowhere. There wasn't anything really going wrong in my life. But as we dug deeper, I was having a lot of sleep issues. I wasn't sleeping well at night. And my wife and I came to find out that your serotonin levels in your brain replenish and regulate themselves while you're sleeping. So somebody that consistently doesn't sleep well has irregular serotonin levels, which causes them to become depressed, which causes them to not sleep well. And it just becomes this endless cycle until you can treat one or the other.
Yeah, perfect example. That's exactly it. And so these are really simple examples, right, where there's just two outputs. In real life, there are extremely complex instances of feedback loops that involve dozens or hundreds of different outputs that eventually come back around and reinforce that feedback. So those were all examples of positive feedback loops. A negative feedback loop would be to think of something like the relationship between predators and prey in an environment. If more prey are introduced into the system, it will increase the amount of predators that are allowed to live in the area, right? Because there's more for them to consume. But if more predators come to the area, they will lessen the amount of prey by eating them, and that will require that some of the predators then leave the area. So that's a negative feedback loop. It keeps the system in sort of this equilibrium.
So in each case, it's kind of this cycle of cause and effect. But in one case, it's causing things to just exponentially increase, whereas in the other case, it's actually a form of balance and, like you said, equilibrium.
Yeah, if I think about it on like a 3D scale, a positive feedback loop is like a spiral, right, that continues to grow upwards as it expands. And as it grows upwards, it might even grow bigger and wider as it goes. A negative feedback loop is just a loop. It's like a hula hoop, right? It goes around and around and around, but it doesn't grow or shrink because it's kept at that equilibrium.
Makes sense.
So when talking about climate change, positive feedback loops are what are primarily discussed because they are the forces that take us away from the equilibrium and towards an imbalance. There are so many positive feedback loops to discuss with the climate crisis, but like I mentioned, today we're going to focus on one aspect of the climate that is of special interest right now, because we're currently witnessing this feedback loop continue and get out of control, and it's causing a series of other feedback loops to take place, and it's the melting of Arctic sea ice. So put very simply, Arctic ice is important because it acts as the Earth's air conditioner. It keeps the polar regions cool, which helps regulate the climate for the rest of the world. It reflects much of the sun's rays back out into the atmosphere, which prevents Earth from absorbing its heat. And the cool temperature of Arctic ice also keeps ocean currents flowing, so it moves water around the globe like a conveyor belt. And those currents are important to regulate the climate and are critical for marine life. Just like ice powers the ocean's currents, it also powers the jet streams, which dictate what weather patterns are around the world. Suffice it to say, having cold, ice-covered polar regions is critical to our current way of life. Pretty much entire civilizations have been created based on the unique climatic attributes of the areas that they're created in. And those attributes are there because of Arctic ice and cold polar regions. So for example, Kellen, you and I have both lived in Latin America. When I lived in Colombia, I noticed how the homes were constructed way differently. You probably noticed the same thing in Mexico. They had no insulation. The windows didn't have glass in them. Besides the security bars, they were just open, right? There weren't really lawns. Patios were all made of tile. The food was significantly different, as were the beverages. Clothing was very different as well. So the entire culture and way of life kind of revolves around the climate of that area. And that's the same story all over the globe. It has always been consistently that way because our climate has stayed consistent over time. So as Arctic ice is threatened, so too is the consistent climate that we know around the world. And some people think that like polar bears and Eskimos are the only ones threatened by a changing Arctic, but it's so much more than that.
So briefly, what you've explained to me is that for everybody, no matter where you live, the Arctic ice is important. I'm intrigued to hear what this has to do with feedback loops. and what I need to know about what is going on with the ice right now.
Yeah, so Arctic melt and freezing is cyclical. It's normal for it to kind of go through this freezing in the wintertime, melting a little bit in the summer, freezing again in the winter. And there are different ways to measure the amount of ice that there is at any one time in the Arctic. The most popular ways are by measuring its extent and also by measuring its volume. For the purpose of this episode, we'll use extent, basically just meaning the area of the ocean that's covered by ice. And by the way, just to clarify and make sure it's clear, so when we're talking about the Arctic Ocean, this is the North Pole. So Antarctica on the South Pole is a completely different case. It is not threatened as much as the Arctic Ocean and the North Pole is right now. So we will talk about Antarctica in a later episode and where it fits in with climate change, but the current most pressing matters are happening to the north. So up until the end of the 1970s, wintertime would see a maximum extent of ice around 16 million square kilometers. And so every year they'd get about that much, 16 million total square kilometers, and a summertime minimum of between 8 and 9 million. So a little less than half of the ice during the summer would melt away and then refreeze again in the winter. Much of that ice is what is called multi-year ice. So over time, ice freezes thicker and more dense. If it doesn't melt one year, it can be built upon the next year. It becomes more solid. The longer it's been around, the harder it is to melt. So for that reason, having a lot of multi-year ice is critical for overall ice health. So today, wintertime maximum extent is around 14 million square kilometers. So the ice usually covers about the same as much in the winter as it used to, slightly less. But the summertime minimum extent in 2020 was only 3.74 million square kilometers. So when you compare that to the 8 or 9 million that it should be, it's quite a bit less. And if you look at a graph of sea ice minimum extent year over year, you see a steady downward shift, which has especially been accelerating over just the last 10 to 20 years. And what that 3.74 number doesn't show is the condition of that ice that's left. In the 1980s, when they first started measuring the age of ice, they calculated that at least 16 or so percent of that was multi-year ice. In 2018, that dropped to 1% and is likely now much less than that. So hardly any of the ice that's left has been around for more than 1 year. The remaining ice is also super thin, so about 60% of the thickness has been lost since the 1980s. It's now fragile, and every year much less of it remains during those peak summer months. And so sea ice loss has been accelerating. It's not a consistent decrease, and due to strong storms and things like the El Nino effect, some years can drop drastically lower than others. In 2012, for example, it was an El Nino year that also had a strong Arctic cyclone that broke up the ice. So ice levels that year dropped way lower than they'd ever been, and each year since then has not been as bad. So if you look at a graph, 2012 like dipped way down, then it came back up. But since then, you know, this year almost matched how bad 2012 was in extent. And it's actually much worse when it comes to thickness, age, and overall quality of the ice. So it's pretty significant that in just 8 years, the average summer is as bad and in many ways worse than that catastrophic year was in 2012. And so it's kind of scary to think about what this next decade's going to hold for the Arctic.
So what I'm hearing from you is that there's a lot less ice that's refreezing each winter. And you mentioned like the quality of the ice, like how solid it is, how thick it is. But a question that comes to my mind, you mentioned that 2012 was an El Nino year and it had this catastrophic effect, but that caused like a big dip and then things kind of bounced back up. So even if this year is really bad, could it just be that next year things kind of rebound?
So there's a big difference between climate and weather. And what we experienced in 2012 was bad weather. And the temporary bad weather did cause a huge dip in the amount of ice that there was that year. But the climate is what is more worrying, because the climate is what is consistently changing. And in the Arctic, there's actually something called Arctic amplification, which means that the climate in the Arctic Ocean is changing much faster than the rest of the planet. So while the Earth on average has increased 1 degree Celsius above the pre-industrial average, like we spoke about in the last episode, the temperature in the Arctic has actually increased between 3 and 5 degrees Celsius in that same time. So what happened this year in 2020 with the melt was bad, It was worse than last year, but last year was also worse than the year before that and worse than the year before that. So it's this trend of continually decreasing ice over time that is worrying.
And if that trend were to continue, does that mean that we at some point will just have no Arctic ice?
Yeah, good question. So that actually comes back to what I mentioned at the beginning of this episode, which is what is referred to as a BOE. So in the climate change community, there's a milestone being watched out for that serves as an enormous red flag. It's not a cataclysmic event which would suddenly herald in this collapse of the climate, but it signals that we've hit a super serious and worrying point, and likely a tipping point that we won't be able to come back from. And it's called a blue ocean event. So BOE, blue ocean event. And it's the first time that the Arctic Ocean will be essentially ice-free, defined by less than 1 million square kilometers total of ice. So as previously mentioned here, up until very recently, scientists believed we wouldn't see a blue ocean event until at least the end of the century. They're now saying that it looks like more like the mid-2030s. And I personally believe that it's going to actually be before that, in my opinion, this decade. What do I know? Not that much. But because of the continual new evidence that keeps coming up and the whole faster than expected thing, they just keep shrinking that time frame to sooner and sooner.
By the way, I'm really grateful for an acronym that's so easy to remember. I'm a very visual person, so you're just saying if I'm looking at the globe, if I'm looking at the Arctic Ocean, there would be hardly any white. It would be a blue ocean. And is that over the course of a year? What did you say there?
Yeah, so that would be if at any time there was less than 1 million square kilometers. So in 2020, the minimum extent was 3.74 million. If it had gotten down to below 1 million, we would have had our first BOE.
Okay, got it.
So the reason that it's considered a tipping point is because the feedback loops that are already happening now and that would especially come into play with a blue ocean event would cause ice to struggle to refreeze in the winter and would cause it to melt much faster every year in the summer. So once we have a BOE, we will likely have it every year, and we will likely have it for longer periods each year thereafter. So that would cause a more rapid disruption of the necessary climate regulation we spoke about earlier that comes from having that Arctic ice. And not only that, but it would also intensify existing feedback loops and create others that would cause the planet to warm well above the 2-degree goal set for the Paris Climate Accord. So let's dive in then and take a look at what some of those feedback loops are. The first is called the albedo effect, and we've already made reference to it in this episode. Albedo in any sense means essentially light that is reflected off of a surface. It's common knowledge that if you wear a black shirt outside in the summer, it's going to be hotter than if you were to wear a white shirt outside in the summer. You can actually touch that shirt and feel the heat on it, and it will make you sweat more than wearing a white shirt would. Last week, in the questions that you asked me, you brought up a new type of white paint being used to paint commercial rooftops and things like that. And so the purpose of that is to reflect the sun's rays and keep that heat from being absorbed by the building or the roadway or whatever it might be. So ice is shiny and bright, and therefore it is very reflective. The ocean is dark blue or even approaching black, which means it absorbs heat. So in a blue ocean event, this is kind of one of the main feedback loops that's being referenced in that. We have this wide open, dark blue ocean that absorbs heat instead of reflects it back out into the atmosphere. So as a matter of fact, ice reflects between 50 and 70% of the solar radiation it comes in contact with, whereas the ocean reflects only 6% and absorbs the rest. So we're talking about an absorption rate of, 94% for the ocean. So the feedback here is pretty obvious. As any open water around the ice absorbs heat, it works to melt the ice from underneath. But as that melts the ice, there's now less ice to reflect heat, which means the ocean is going to be absorbing more heat and continue that feedback loop.
Okay, so essentially less ice makes it so the Arctic is even hotter, which means there's even less ice, which makes it even hotter.
We could go on for days.
Got it.
Yep. Okay, so the next is water vapor. So as the oceans warm up because of loss of albedo effect, it increases the humidity, so the amount of water vapor in the air. Every degree of global warming is said to increase the amount of water vapor by 7%. So as we go from 0 to 1 degrees above the baseline or 1 to 2, it just increases the water vapor by 7% in the air. So water vapor is actually a greenhouse gas, and it has a couple of really interesting effects. So more water vapor equals more clouds. And clouds are really interesting because scientists are actually having a really hard time measuring or predicting the effects of increased clouds due to climate change. Clouds are in one way a negative feedback because they're bright, they're more reflective than the Earth's surface, so they actually increase albedo and lessen the amount the Earth warms due to the sun's rays. But they're also a positive feedback because they act as insulation to keep heat trapped on the Earth. If you've ever been outside, like in the winter, cloudy days are always much warmer than cloudless days. So that condensed water vapor retains heat. It's going to be really interesting to see if increased cloud cover is a net positive or negative when it comes to heating the Earth. But one thing that's certainly true is that it will increase the amount of rainfall over certain parts of the Earth. Because of the change in climate in certain areas and the slowdown of the jet streams, which we're going to talk about in just a minute, that rain will not be spread out evenly and will likely fall too much and too hard, too fast in certain parts of the world. So while some areas might not get any rain and have consistent droughts, others are going to be constantly flooded. And also the increased energy in the atmosphere from that increase in water vapor will cause and has already caused an increase in the amount of severe storms and hurricanes that we see. So the increase in the intensity and number of hurricanes that we've seen in this year, which was a record-breaking year, is due to the amount of water vapor and heat energy in the atmosphere because of a warming ocean.
You mentioned that just because there's a net gain in rainfall across the globe, that doesn't mean that every area is going to receive equally. Like you said, some areas will have consistent drought, while others get way more rainfall than they should. You also mentioned earlier that the Arctic region of the globe is warming at a faster rate than the rest of the globe. And it just brings me back to one of the questions I brought up, or one of the concerns that we talked about in the last episode, which is when people are saying, like, hey, this is the coldest winter we've had on record in this state or in this area. So global warming is just a bunch of bunk, right? But I think this goes to show that global warming doesn't just mean everybody's always a lot warmer. It means things are going to get crazier.
Yeah, so there's actually a climate scientist by the name of Paul Beckwith. He is super fascinating, funny guy. He has some really interesting YouTube videos that he does. He records a 15-minute video almost every day about something going on in the climate. And he's come up with this term that he calls global weirding. So it's not just global warming, like you said, where everyone feels like the Earth's just going to get way hotter in every place and it's consistent everywhere. It's more like the climate becomes weird. We're not used to certain things in certain areas happening, and it does. There's all these anomalies or thousand-year storms and events that are happening fairly consistently. And so, yeah, when we talk about the average temperature of the Earth has increased by 1 degree, well, in some places, maybe it hasn't changed much yet. And in other places, it's changed by 5 degrees, right? And so those places are the ones that are going to really notice a difference. And over time, as those differences amplify, especially in a place as important as the Arctic, it has an effect on the climate of the entire globe as a whole. So the next feedback loop, and this one's fascinating to me, is called latent heat, or the latent heat of fusion. Yeah, it's a really sciencey, nerdy term, I guess. But this one's especially worrying. So latent heat of fusion is basically the extra amount of heat energy that has to go into ice in order to melt it. So in other words, melting ice takes a lot more heat energy than just heating up water. So to explain that, imagine you have two stovetops right next to each other. You turn them on to the same temperature. On one burner, you place a pound of ice in a pot. And on the other burner, you place a pound of water at just barely above freezing. By the time the pound of ice completely melts to 33 degrees Fahrenheit or 1 degree Celsius, the water in the other pot will have warmed up to 175 degrees Fahrenheit. Or 79 degrees Celsius. So the same amount of energy that it takes to melt ice will heat the same amount of water from freezing to 175 degrees Fahrenheit. So we didn't really change the temperature of the ice, not by much. We simply changed it from a solid state to a liquid state. But that same amount of heat energy, though, got us pretty much 80% of the way to boiling the other water.
Yeah, and already as you explained that, I can see where this is going. That once there's not all that ice to melt in the Arctic, it's going to cause the temperature to increase drastically.
Yeah, it will. And there's another way to look at it too that makes it even more intense. So imagine now that you have a large pot of water that you place on a stove, and you place a chunk of ice in that pot and turn the stove on. So if you put a thermometer in the water, you'll notice that the temperature of the water itself changes very little as long as there's still ice in the pot. So even though the stovetop might be heated to like 200, 250 degrees, the temperature of the water is not really changing. What's changing is the ice. And that's because all that heat energy goes to the ice first in an effort to melt it. Once the ice melts, then the temperature of the water skyrockets. So right now, any heat from any of the oceans surrounding the Arctic is getting sucked up by the ice in an effort to melt it. But the temperature of the ocean itself and that water stays relatively stable. So even though there's a lot of heat entering the oceans from both the sun's radiation and from increased temperature due to CO2, all that heat is being absorbed by the ice right now. So once that ice melts and it's gone, so once we have our first BOE, the temperature of not just the Arctic, but the surrounding water as well is expected to increase dramatically. And it's not going to happen all at once. It's not like we're saying that once the ice is melted, the temperature of the Arctic is going to increase to 175 degrees Fahrenheit. That's not it at all. But basically, all that energy that's going into melting the ice will very quickly start to increase and change the temperature of the Arctic Ocean.
So you weren't kidding when you said that the ice acts as the Earth's air conditioner. It seems like in so many ways that you've mentioned, it is helping regulate the temperature, it's helping to cool everything down, and I can see why this is a huge deal.
Yeah, outside of the Arctic, there's not really any ice that's in the water. And so having that ice in the water absorbing heat and then coming back again the next year just created this consistent equilibrium of that cooling effect. And so once that's gone, because now we're getting rid of more ice every year than can be replenished, we're basically destroying that air conditioner. And so as that ice melts and the ocean itself warms up, and also the air above the ocean warms up because there's an increase in water vapor and all these things we've talked about, this will start to have a huge effect on Greenland ice. So Greenland is a massive country. And it has just an unimaginable amount of ice on it. So there's certain areas where the ice is 10,000 feet thick. It's just crazy. If all of the ice on Greenland melted, it would cause the sea levels to rise by 23 feet, or about 7 meters. Obviously, that won't happen in our lifetime, but just to put it into perspective, as many as 3.7 million U.S. residents across 2,150 coastal areas would be affected by an increase of just 19 inches in sea level. So a foot and a half would have severe consequences to much of our coast. And this is not just because a 19-inch rise would necessarily permanently flood those cities. But as the sea level rises, it increases the potential for flooding during high tides, hurricanes. It increases the likelihood, not just the severity, but the actual likelihood of tsunamis. And a lot of projections say that by 2050, many cities that would normally experience 1-in-1,000-year flooding are going to be experiencing more like 1-in-5-year flooding events. They become so frequent and so often that it becomes uneconomical to be able to even live on the coast.
You know, I think of a lake that my family used to go to growing up, and I remember one year hearing that because of all the rainfall that year, the lake was like 8 inches higher. And I was blown away that once we got there, once we got to the lake, the beaches were just gone. So when you talk about all the miles of coastline that would be affected and all the millions of residents, and I'm sure globally, maybe even billions of people that would be affected, that completely makes sense to me. And I've even heard that there's other things, like beyond just all the crazy stuff you're talking about, seawater would be getting into natural springs and into private wells. And all of that put together just makes me think that any sort of a rise in the global sea level would be terrifying.
Yeah, and there's actually a name for that. They call it saltwater intrusion, saltwater creep. Basically, it's the ocean, as it rises, it makes its way inland. And it destroys soil as it goes up rivers. It destroys water systems, all these things like you said. So it's much more than just 8 inches, 12 inches, 2 feet. It has a much worse impact than it sounds. So, you know, 40% of the world's population lives within about 60 miles of the coast. We are heavily reliant on the coast because there are centers of trade. It's considered luxurious to be able to live on the beach, that sort of thing. But it is also one of the most dangerous and will likely become one of the most costly. Also important to note is that ice melting isn't the only contributor to sea level rise. So as water becomes warmer, it actually expands. And so as the ocean heats up, it will expand and cause sea levels to rise even more than just whatever melts off of the Greenland ice sheet. So earlier I had mentioned jet streams, and basically what those are tight streams of air current that flow around the globe. Usually they meander in a slightly wavy pattern, but are for the most part pretty tight. And those dictate where our cold fronts come from, temperature of certain areas, and those basically regulate and keep our climate consistent. As Arctic amplification increases and the temperature of the North Pole matches more closely the temperature of the rest of the Earth, though, that causes that jet stream to meander much more and move much more both to the north and the south. Before, it used to be that the cold to the north and the warm to the south would keep that jet stream sandwiched. But as that temperature increases to the north, it allows that jet stream to start moving around a lot more. And so what this does is it actually causes cold air from the north to be taken south by those jet streams, and the warm air from the south to then be taken north. If you need a visualization of what I'm talking about here, just Google jet stream, look at the images, and you'll see, I think we all kind of have that image, but of just this, essentially a wave across the earth that goes up and down. And so as it starts to meander more, as it starts to elongate and go further north and further south, this causes longer cold spells in North America and Europe and abnormally high temperatures in the Arctic. So it's basically just moving all that heat and all that cold around in a way that we're not used to. So that shift in the normal weather patterns can lead to things like crop failures, food shortages, infrastructure problems. You know, imagine if a place that normally doesn't need AC, like Alaska, all of a sudden has this warm air coming in from the south and they're more consistently hot. You now have a state full of people who are not used to living through 90 and 100 degree days having to figure out how to do that. And like I mentioned before, the culture and everything that they're used to is now upended by this new climate that they're experiencing. So similarly, ocean currents are also slowed down by a warming Arctic. So one of the planet's main ocean currents is called the AMOC, which is a much less easy to remember acronym. But what it does is it basically circulates water all the way around the globe in sort of a conveyor belt. And it actually takes some of this water more than 1,000 years to make the whole trip. It's pretty fascinating. But studies have found that the AMOC has slowed down 15% since just the 1950s. There's a movie called The Day After Tomorrow, which is kind of like a doomsday apocalyptic type movie. It's basically an exaggerated example of what would happen if the AMOC came to a complete halt. And that really isn't necessarily the concern, but it slowing down does mean that there would be more heat waves in the northern hemisphere, as well as droughts, more severe winter storms, and would even cause sea level on the east coast of the United States to climb by quite a bit. One thing to note is that the AMOC is further slowed down by Greenland ice melting because the introduction of that fresh water into the salty ocean disrupts the way those currents move as well. You can imagine the sort of issues that this type of thing would bring up for marine life. Not just the ocean changing temperature, but the AMOC slowing down or decreasing, the jet streams changing, fresh water being introduced into salt water. All of these things have a severe impact on marine life and ocean ecosystems. We talked a little bit previously about how those are currently being impacted. You know, the coral reefs are being bleached, which just means they're dying. You know, we're expected to not have any more fish by 2048. And this all plays a large part in essentially assuring that that is what happens.
I'll just jump in and say, I can see why it was so important to start this episode talking about feedback loops. Because as you describe all the global chaos that we can expect from just these seemingly slight changes, those intensify as everything responds to these other outputs and the feedback loops continue and everything just accelerates. So I can also see why it's so difficult for scientists to predict exactly what's going to happen or when it's going to happen. But I think the clear message here is that we're on a pretty scary path.
Yeah, and not only is it difficult for scientists to be able to predict what's going to happen, like you said, with any sort of accuracy, but this also shows why everyday people haven't really taken a huge interest in this. It's not headline news. People aren't panicking about it. Because if they were to open up the newspaper and see something like the AMOC slowed down 15% over the last 70 years, it doesn't mean anything to anyone. It doesn't inspire any sort of emotion in people, right? Or even just say something like Arctic ice is melting. Like the impact of it doesn't really hit. And so it takes time. It takes effort to really actually look into it and see what does this actually mean.
But the kind of headline that people do react to is a hurricane is headed your way. And I can see why with the results we're beginning to see from climate change, people collectively are starting to pay more and more attention to it.
Yeah, it's true. They are. And like we've said before, there will always be people that will find any reason to not believe it and say, well, there's always been hurricanes and all these sorts of things. And it's all nonsense. But now is an important time and a more important time than ever for people to realize this is happening and it's going to happen quickly. And there's very little, if any, time left to make changes necessary to mitigate the damage. So I left the maybe scariest for last here. We'll end with this last feedback loop, which is that of methane. So we've talked a lot about CO2, carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas emitted by our modern industrial complex. But there's another major greenhouse gas, which is methane, which is actually 84 times as potent as carbon dioxide. It just doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. So it has the potential to raise the temperature of the Earth very fast and do a lot of damage all at once. But we don't hear it talked about as much because it's not as prevalent as carbon dioxide is. So we've all heard about like permafrost found in the Arctic. That permafrost, or soil that stays frozen all year round, acts as a sort of lid or container for methane deposits in the Earth. And as things are warming up in the Arctic, that permafrost is starting to melt, and it's causing those deposits to leak out. Over the last few years, there have been wildfires called zombie fires that have actually been openly burning during the summer in Siberia, in northern Russia. And then during the winter, they continue to burn and smolder underground just to spark back up again in the summer. So it's actually fires that stay lit year-round and burn inside the soil. This is causing mass melting of permafrost and leaks of methane as well. At the bottom of the Arctic Ocean, under the sea floor, there is insane amounts of methane that as the Arctic warms up, and right now, we're barely starting to see the Arctic water itself starting to warm up to a point and releasing some of those reserves of methane under the ocean floor. But as the ice melts, and like we talked about, once the latent heat of fusion takes over and raises the temperature of that water, it's going to release much more of this methane out of the ocean floor.
And I'm kind of laughing to myself over here because I hear you use the term zombie fires, and already all of this is sounding like a nightmare. And suddenly you introduce something that just sounds like it came from a sci-fi movie.
Yeah, and when it comes to the Arctic, there's actually quite a few of those things. So relevant to what we're talking about, they talk about methane bombs. They talk about something called the clathrate gun hypothesis. And then also, I mean, when you consider permafrost and ice that has been frozen for tens of thousands or millions of years, and the type of bacterias and viruses that are potentially pent up in all of that, that right now as it's melting, those are potentially released out into our environment. Like if we thought COVID-19 is bad, we have no idea what types of bacterias have been frozen in time that could potentially be currently released right now into animals or humans. So it's kind of crazy to think about the Arctic and really how it is. It's an unknown territory. There's so many potential disasters to come out of it that we can't really know or understand them at all. So I'm going to link to some pictures and articles in the description of some really large craters in the Earth that have been found that were formed by methane exploding out of the ground. So there's these big deposits of it that will just come bursting out. Some in the climate industry believe that methane is one of the biggest threats to our climate because a rapid melting and release of methane could increase the average temperature of the Earth by several degrees all on its own. Recent studies have found areas of the Arctic where as much as 400 times as much methane as is normal being released from the ocean floor. So it's something to watch closely as it's currently happening. And by the way, this is a pretty new thing, just the last decade or so, seeing this amount of methane coming out of the Arctic. For perspective, though, before the 2000s, the Arctic was estimated to release about 500,000 tons of methane per year. In 2006, that increased to 3.8 million tons of methane per year. and in 2013 it was 17 million. So it's increasing rapidly. I couldn't find a number for 2020 or 2019. But it's important to note that those numbers actually pale in comparison to the amount of methane currently being released by agriculture and the burning of fossil fuels, which hit nearly 600 million tons this last year. So while the current amount of methane that's being released from the Arctic isn't super substantial, but it's estimated that the Arctic permafrost and seafloor contains no less than 1.4 trillion tons of methane. And so there are theories that as much as 50 billion tons at a single time could be released if enough melting happens or we hit certain tipping points. In reality, our knowledge and understanding of methane is super limited. But the danger it presents, the potential for rapid warming it could cause, can't be understated or dismissed. So it'll just be really interesting to watch over the next couple of years and see what happens, if it's going to increase exponentially, or if it just kind of stays a threat in the background.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of unknowns with that, but there's definitely a lot that we do know and a lot that we're seeing take place. And it almost sounds like we could spend an entire episode or multiple episodes just on methane or just on the jet stream or just on the albedo factor, any of these things that you've brought up. There's so much to digest here. And I take a step back and realize, like, this isn't a climate change podcast, although I'm sure we'll talk about it a lot in the future. But to think that all of this is happening, in addition to all the other aspects of collapse that we've talked about, and I just think, wow, there is so much for me to learn and so much that I wish everybody knew.
Yeah, and like I mentioned, we're trying to keep these episodes high level, and then with each one, we'll dig down a little deeper. So while we already did an episode on climate change where we talked about the consequences of it, again, in this episode, we dove in a little deeper to talk about the causes and some of those feedback loops. And later on, we can go into individual episodes, like you said, to dive in deeper into methane and into the jet stream and into the AMOC and all of those things. And so that will come. In the end, I think the warming of the Arctic is super interesting because it is happening right now before our eyes. Like I had said, everyday people who see this pop up every now and then on like a mainstream news site don't think much of it. But now that you've heard this, now that we've had this discussion, I kind of challenge you to pay more attention to that when you see those, or even to search it out and watch what unfolds in each of these areas in the coming months and years. So the ice will start melting again in March. At least I say it should start melting in March. So we'll come back and check up on that next year. Throughout the melt season, we'll kind of see where it's at, how it compares to previous years. And as new news comes out about things like methane and the jet streams, we'll touch back. We'll have this episode to reference when we say, you know, hey, they now found that the AMOC has slowed down 20% instead of 15%. We'll know the significance of that and what it means. So I look forward, Kellen, to future episodes, continuing to break this down. We've got tons of awesome episodes planned. We do appreciate your support. We appreciate you for listening. Just a reminder that we've set up a Patreon account. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, helping Kellen and I continue to move forward doing this, any help you can give is greatly appreciated. Kellen and I do this to try and make an impact, try and inform people. And so supporting us on Patreon is a great way to help out. Other ways to help out, though, would be sharing this podcast with a friend, or if you're enjoying the podcast, please feel free to leave a review wherever you listen so that it gets more eyes and so that more people can find the podcast. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.